Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from Western North Carolina, our AccuWindow forecast. 81 degrees, a little bit cloudy, so it's going to be a nice program tonight. In 1997, the notion that grays were sophisticated biological robots created by an extraterrestrial civilization long since gone made its debut. The correlation of the abduction activities of the Greys with their nefarious purpose stunned the UFO community. Human DNA was being manipulated to create a race of something much more significant than a hybrid or a clone. What you are about to hear may free you from the darkest designs on the human race. Well, you're in for a treat tonight on X Squared Radio. We are interviewing Nigel Kerner, the author of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Nigel, I gotta tell you, the depth of thought and the power in your writing is rare and inspirational. You know, we have been wrestling with the question of whether UFOs exist and what an alien might be. You begin with a more important question, and I'd like to ask it to you now and see where we go with it. What are we? What are humans?
Well, if it's as simply put as that, the answer is a much more complex thing as I see it. And after 37 years of research into this question, inspired incidentally by a question asked of me by my son, Darren, Dad, are UFOs real? I kind of launched on a research project to give him an answer that was worthy of his mind, rather than my instinct to say, look, this is Buck Rogers stuff. It's not something you ought to deal with and wouldn't get you too far and so on in a Mickey Mouse kind of world. Well, it turned out that as I went into it more deeply, that something astonishing revealed itself to me, so much so that it actually turned me over, and over 37 years, the entire span of whatever existential ideas I might have had were completely revised, and I would say, I'd accent the word, completely revised in the thrall of all that I was discovering. So the question about UFOs then led me, when you connected up the dots, into all kinds of different directions, and I was kind of, I found myself being forced into trying to actually account for almost everything about what humanity is all about. Now, to get more to your question, we, it seems, are some kind of facsimile that came from a naturally derived life form that came through with the beginning of the universe. And with everything, and please bear with me as I say this, because it is a little bit of a story, and in terms of how I see this anyway, and the entire thing began from the whole acquisition of the universal outlay, shall we say, dimensions and everything. And of course, I had to try and explain all of that to connect up all the dots in such a way that there's some kind of coherent thesis here that follows later on. So I had to go back into how all of this might have happened and so forth, and how into the universe there came a power that held within it intelligence and what we might generally describe, in human terms at least, as the power of will and the sense of awareness we all have in order to make whatever we do of the universe as beings. So something wondrous happened in terms of this incredible explosion that created everything. And out of it came into the universe these fractions that give us a purpose and a place and all the rest of it. Now, the interesting thing is that if such a thing occurs, how is this particular thing explained in terms of the commonly held philosophies of Darwin and things like that? Well, I had to throw all of that out of the window, because to look at the logical sequence that came from this particular occurrence all those billions of years ago, one had to look fresh and to look neutrally, and with none of my prejudices hitched up either to my eyes or anywhere else on me, had to actually clean out the chest, so to speak, and have a fresh look at how all of this might have happened. Throw away all the things I had been taught about and the derivational systems up until that point, and so forth. And something absolutely wonderful, a kind of came over whilst I was doing the research. If I may just stop this for a moment, I think Dr. Simon wants to come in here.
Thank you, Nigel. I was just going to say, one of the things that really impressed me about Nigel's thesis and his ideas when I first read a manuscript years ago of something that he had written is when he talks about something called devolution, the idea that actually that there is the second law of thermodynamics means that things don't progress to greater states of order, but the opposite. And this actually, it takes in Darwin and takes it further, because, of course, Darwin was talking about survival of the fittest. But survival in what sense? Because, as we all know, insects would survive a nuclear holocaust far better than humans would. So what type of survival are we talking about? And I think this is one of the main themes of Nigel's books, that there's two kinds of survival. There's the survival of a rock or a robot that keeps replicating programs. And then there's another kind of survival of mind, of the ability to be aware and to choose. This is a capacity that on this planet, at least, we know is present in humans. And how does that survive? How does that continue? Sorry, that was just...
No, that's all right. I just want to throw in, you know, it's difficult to answer a question that someone puts to you like that, because then your mind goes racing and you don't want to start the answer, well, first the Earth cooled, and then you get lost, because you can go 1,000 different directions with answering the question. But yeah. what I like about the core of the way you approached it is... You inserted the principle of irreducible complexity right off the bat, and that somewhere in there, there was either a breakdown or a recombination, a purposeful recombination of things that were already irreducibly complex, and that is where the book really caught my eye. So go ahead.
Yes. Well, we had to look at that point at which all of this cascades down into, as Andrew made the point, devolution. This whole business is really evolution within devolution. This is where I take a completely different look at this from the prevailing wisdom that Darwin comes up with, evolution. Most people take this evolution business. Actually, it's not what Darwin actually said. They think evolution is some kind of platform to betterment. All it is an adaptation to a present situation as you decay down. And of course, with a universe that has breaking parts going into gathering states of randomness and chaos with time, as the second law of thermodynamics dictates, you've got then to follow this premise and see where do we go from here, if you're going to go with any logic at all. So I looked at this particular thing and had to take in the fact that things must have been better when it came through with the universe. How would they be better? How could they be assembled? How is knowledge, knowing, and all of that retained within the artifacts of an explosion and so forth, and try to bring that together by connecting up the dots, as I say, into an actual intelligible outlay at the end of it all. And so I start off with an existential mechanism of two poles. One, it's all to do with opposites. One pole is where all things come together into an absolute coherence of the whole in all in perfect union and harmony. And the other pole would be its opposite. We've got a yin and a yang, a plus and a minus. We've got the, you know, usual positron, electron, whatever. Everything has a particular opposite. And if you juxtapose these ideas, this natural cadence, logical cadence down, you will have to account for this business of two poles interacting, their potential difference, of course, meeting in the middle, an interface which then buds off universes like ours with an amalgam of both contained within it, which means that all that is together an absolute and perfect knowledge and knowing is mixed in with the opposite momentum, which is breaking it up all the time. And we have both of those things, as we all note, in our universe of parts, as we know it as such. And so here we are, through all the centuries, coming down into, as you say, we came with light, and then we came with into gas, and then with liquid, and then we have stages of solid. And that's sort of the arrangements of matter come down in that kind of sequence. And into this, we have to feed in such a wonder as the human element or our species. And of course, this is happening all over the universe in countless billions of planets. And, you know, just to digress a moment, you know, recently science has been telling us that there are now many, many hundreds of thousands of Earth-like planets out there. You've then got from that the association with, well, have they all got a god that's, you know, rather like the old chap in the Sistine Chapel, with his flowing beard pointing his finger at Adam and all that business?
Yeah.
Or, hey, what is this god concept all about? You see how it happens, Brooks. You just have to look at all of these things as you take this new stance and bring it forward. And so, therefore, the interesting thing for me was, from that simple question of what is a UFO, I was having to explain the genesis of humankind and how humankind sat on this existential platform, and this entire thing then unfolded to our present contemporary stance on matters and so on. So,
well,
for
the idea that you're laying down an existential premise would mean that there has to be an assumption of awareness. Because in order to exist, really, you have to be aware that you're existing. I mean, a penguin is not self-aware, and yet it survives. It has instincts mechanisms.
Some might argue with the fact that that animals aren't self-aware. I think they have a notion of all of that. A crow, for instance, will pick up a stick and work out something for food from a difficult set of circumstances. And, of course, people will look at this and say, look, this animal has intelligence. He is trying to get the food. The premise is to continue his life, whatever. And this is the way he contrives doing it. And so it's a very simple thing. People talk about, you know, how long it took mankind to invent the wheel. Well, if an animal can do this, it's a really big question. Why didn't we do this for 3 or 4 million years with prior types of man? You know, there is something here that's out of kilter, so to speak.
Right. This new idea of biosemiotics sort of assumes that even insects have some sort of primitive sense of awareness, that they it's just that the notions that they're using, for example, the example I read about recently is that a tick will sit on a blade of grass for months on end, and all it's thinking about is all it's aware of is looking for this smell of sweat so that it knows to drop on a creature to take its blood. But yeah, it has that, at least awareness of that, perhaps.
Absolutely. So therefore, its deductive sense would point out its own place in this entire scenario. Now, if I may continue and go back to the kind of point I was making, it's easy.
No,
to
go
get
ahead.
Off
go
the
ahead.
Market. See, for me, the whole universe as we know it, that thing that cascaded from the interaction of two primal existential poles, this universe of ours is a hive of force. So therefore, you would conclude that its opposite end would be no force whatsoever. Each point within our universe of parts, as I call our home, as living beings, is a huge field of tension. It is a tension that's caused by potential differences between two absolute poles, as I said before. The pole I call the pole of perfect harmony, and its opposite, utter chaos. And God, if you like, as a concept, is representative of one, and the devil, if you like, as a concept, is representative of the other. So to me, there are no heebie-jeebies, if you like, in this world. It's very simply explained. If you use semantics, you can use one, you can call that God, and you can call the other thing the devil, if you like. So
sure.
We've got two things there. One that's breaking things apart and making it much more complex, as you said in your introduction. And of course, the other thing that returns things from whence they came into a situation of total parity and harmony, and from which all things may be known and seen within an implied singularity, I, for want of a better word, would call Godhead, not to be too religious about it and so on. So the point is that there is it's much better seen neutrally and in a secular way, but there is no reason why anyone who wants to have a sense of it as a personalized entity, if you like, might call it God. I have no qualms about things like that. So the basic scales against which all existence can be understood is based on the properties of the purely atomic physical universe, as we know it, set against what I call the Godverse, a non-physical world that exists in, I believe, in the space between atoms, which may be described as a zero-point field, if you like, outside space, the space-time continuum, and below the minimum level of force it takes to kind of self-sustain the atomic world of, you know, space-time, mass, matter, atoms, etc., and so on. So there are three basic scales here based on this paradigm. That which is natural and has its origins in the Godverse, and that which is artificial and has its origins in our universe, the artifact of the interaction of two basic existential poles. And then the second would be that which lives in the sense that we understand the living process biologically, and that which is not living, table, chair, statue, whatever you like to describe. And then the third is, you know, that which kind of tends towards the making of the whole out of parts, i.e. the sense of unionizing, caring, loving momentums. It's an emotional accent we talk about here in these kinds of things. It's a psychological invention, if you like. It's an abstraction, but nevertheless, it's the powerful thing. One thought is an abstraction, so we function out of these abstractions. We underestimate them. Science doesn't quantify them or qualify them because they can't really be measured, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
But nevertheless, it drives everything, as you know, and it brings wondrous things about as a result of its momentums and so on.
Well,
so there's, you've got this caring, loving momentum, and that which tends to make parts of the whole come together, and that which makes divisive, self-centered momentums, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure,
so
sure.
There we have, if I may just finish this, there we have this entire scale of reference against which we have to posture everything else, Brooks. And that is a kind of beginning point from which I take in the expression of what we might call human terms of reference and so on, and species come about and so forth, as a result of that large derivational compendium, if you like. See?
Well, so, the idea that one of the parts is living and one of the parts is non-living, one would tend to say, What is life? What is living? I mean, it's not the non-living parts that make me up. I mean, that's about $10 worth of store-bought chemicals. But the living thing that animates this biological transducer in which I exist on this planet, that's the more difficult thing to measure. And the question is, are we then offspring or descendants of some intelligence that is also self-aware?
Well, let's get a medical perspective on this, doctor.
It's difficult to measure, but without which no measurement ever happens, no observation ever happens without the conscious observer.
That's right.
And I've been really fascinated, pleasantly surprised when I read Erwin Schrödinger's book, What is Life? And this is a book by, you know, one of the founders of quantum theory who came up with an equation that is one of the most accurate things that has ever been produced by science. And he said that basically this idea that that science is making a mistake with the empirical outlook, with this idea that you can study the world as though it doesn't have you in it, as though there is no mind, as though it's all just empty, dead particles. What he suggested is that actually mind is fundamental to it, rather than mind being an abstraction within a real, solid, concrete physical universe. Physicality is an abstraction within real, eternal mind. And people might be surprised that I'm saying that the founder of quantum theory spoke about eternal mind, but he was a very rational man, and he had to look at the fact that actually, if you look at space and time, if you take it in the Einsteinian point of view, that the block universe idea, past, mm-hmm. present, and future, mm-hmm. all could be one and the same, and you could see it all together. But yet, as conscious beings, we have this sense of there being a now, a moment, and only that can only happen through sentience. And Schrödinger's great point, which was, I think, a great revelation and a simple logic, is just to say, hang on a minute, if time is a result of the existence of the conscious sentient observer, then how can the conscious sentient observer begin or end in time? We must have to be eternal. And then also, the fact that what is within any of us sentient human beings, whatever nationality, race, creed, color, any of that, it's all the actual awareness sense is the same. What we are aware of may vary from person to person, our own individual memories, experiences, what we do out of choice in our use of our free will, which is another fascinating subject, which hopefully we'll come to later, may be different. But fundamentally, the actual prime nature of mind in all of us is identical. And he said that this pointed to the fact that fundamentally we're all one, and that our division as separate beings, which we make more of through ego, separation, prejudice, selfishness, jealousy, and all of these things, competition. These are all how we divide, and perhaps may actually be, according to Nigel's thesis, which makes a lot of sense to me, may actually be the fundamental momentum which actually caused the Big Bang in the first place.
Yes, yeah. And so this then manifests itself, you see, in the way that I kind of derive it, into what we call life and livingness, to go back to your point. And what exactly is this? See, our individualities are defined by an expression of force against no force. Visualized, if you like, you know, a sheet of paper with holes in it. Where there is paper, there is force. Where there is a hole, there is no force. Mm-hmm. In other words, an area with no paper would be termed, in my reference, a derivation of God, the God-verse within the universe. So I look at it as that place where there is atomic force and all its derivations has its own implication, and that the space between the atoms has a point somewhere right in the center of that space between atoms, where there is no force, through which the God-versian influence comes in, the abstract influence of knowingness, thinkability, all of those kinds of things that provide this background screen we call consciousness and so on. And so from within that frame of reference, we get words like conscience, that final singularity, derivation point it all goes back to, that summarizes everything and gives us a comparative scale against which you can view all other things.
Oh, yeah, it's the measuring force itself. I'm kind of reminded a little bit of Sir Roger Penrose saying that quantum, or that consciousness was the result of quantum gravity. And I rewrote that recently and said, no, actually, quantum gravity is the result of consciousness.
Absolutely, Brooks. Absolutely. Well done. And that's quite true. I believe that is quite true, as far as we can get to truth in a universe of diminishing returns, if you like. You know,
exactly.
We know that, you know, our prized objects or whatever it is made of atoms will decay if they're not looked after by an abstraction we call mind, if you see what I'm trying to say. You don't polish your car and keep it going, it'll end up as a rusty, and
same,
so forth.
The same
and
thing
everything
happens to
goes
my
down in that scalar fashion to a, you know, as a cosmologist now, except a universe that's finite that will end in a sheet of force, of cold, absolute zeroed force, you know, if you see what I'm trying to say. I believe that into this comes the invective of minds that actually said there is another universe, you know, as a universe that goes eternally. and that is within our universe. I mean, you know, the Christian teacher, for instance, Yeshua ben Yosef, to give him his Judaic name, Jesus Christ, to give him the commonly accepted Christian description. He said, you know, in no uncertain terms, that there is another state of being, and a wonderful thing, which we hope to talk about later, that is now being researched, actually proves in the most current day physics that a marvelous truth happened here in Palestine 2,000 years ago through this individual, one that incidentally provides us with the kind of icon, the axiom on which I base everything I write. And that is the value and the glory of a single naturally devised living system. Sorry about the slippage of the tongue. A derived living system called a human being. And that this human thing that we look all over the world and we deride and we kill and we mangle and we insult, we praise and all that kind of thing, is an absolute glory because it has access to an eternal scale of reference, and if careless and ignorant, will probably inherit one that is not. So you see, there is continuity and not, so to speak, mapped out within these kinds of references. And that's the most exciting thing that I discovered from that question my little boy asked me, 12 years old. And I tell you, it's turned my life upside down, and I hope, in some sense, might inspire other people with greater minds than mine to take this forward into something even more great, more meaningful for the new generations coming.
Well, I think that your son was lucky in getting such a rich, deep answer, because once you lay this foundation that we are, in fact, this marvelous, glorious, sentient being capable of observing things into existence, or out of existence for that matter, we should look at ourselves much more jewel-like and less animalistic.
Absolutely, Brooks. And that's the main point, is that we underestimate so much the value of what is ordinariness in human being. Just by implication, we are something wondrous. And we lose sight of this in the day's own troubles, so to speak, and so forth, and the derivations that come out of all of that. And when we have then something else coming in that is not naturally contrived in living intelligence and discernment and so forth, rather like this UFO phenomenon and what people commonly call the greys, for instance. That's the thing that I was looking at in terms of answering Darren's question.
Sure.
And, of course, one then thinks, oh, my goodness, here is something that's not programmed for this. This is a mechanically created thing out of an atomic rule of diminishing returns, a programmed thing that cannot have a reference back to an origin as we all do. Our preciousness is our origin. And to me, a soul, for instance, is quite simply that path of reference that comes from the origin to the present-day incumbent that walks, talks, and all the rest of that, you know, that we call human being.
Now, what would you say that the ability to procreate and to desire something more than mere procreation in combination is the envy of the universe?
I would say that the whole universe is, the meaning of the universe is that, in fact.
Yes.
That, in fact, it's a location in which all these interplays happen. And we've got to derive some sense of what is valuable and absolutely crucial in that final state of all, that final axiom, is quite simply to be there to know. That simple axiom, to be there to exist. And what takes away existence then takes away all and all meaning. And I believe that that's what this great teacher, for instance, who came to Palestine, and all the other great teachers, funnily enough, every one of them, pointed this incredible thing out, that this scale of being there is all that matters. And there are situations where that unitary sense of knowing you are there can be taken away. And I believe that the greatest danger to everyone that exists within our planetary living paradigm is anything that can do that. And that is why I began to explore the UFO business and this idea that there are now, in our purview, kind of roboidic creatures that are being protected on this planet. And that's another story. So that's for another question as we go on.
Yeah, what race of beings created the Greys, and what happened to them?
Well, that is a speculation that is as wide as the universe, is it not, Brooks? Because, I mean, there could be huge numbers of planets out there with all kinds of creatures and so forth, and that provide the living paradigm. The important thing is to look at the basics, because, I mean, we might have such a lot of, such a permutation of parts and so on that are called living being out there. They all face that simple, basic paradigm. Is it living out of a beginning that's natural and cascades down? Or is it artificially created from within the system it is within? And that is the problem.
But this
really
interaction...
It's robots against natural being.
Right.
And that's the big battle.
But yeah, this battle, this interaction of beings who are soulless looking for an avenue to become, to gain a soul...
You said it, absolutely, is
probably not isolated to Earth, although at least in our corner of the universe, based on the radio waves and things that we've been able to pick up, we're the only example of it, so naturally we're a big signpost in the middle of space.
Right there you said it. You see, this is a big problem. I think this is universe-wide. I think we're just discovering that we're not the only ones in the universe. We should have done it a long, long time ago by simple, you know, deductive logic. But, of course, science measures and has its own ways of deriving things and so forth, and we've had to wait for this implication now to dawn on us.
Well, I would say that the Hopi and the Dogon and others already had it figured out. we were so smart that we said, no, you don't know what you're talking about. So for
whatever.
A couple
but,
of
I mean, the point is, whilst we have problems on this Earth within our own, you know, scale of reference, human beings, I'm sure there's an interrelationship between other kinds of entities out there, out with, you know, in an interspatial planetary aspect, you know, if you see what I'm trying to say, doing the same darn thing a billion times over in a multi-billion situation, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Well,
so this is not a big thing. It really is going on. We've just discovered it. So, boy, is it a big thing for us. But I tell you what, we better find out what it's all about, or we may have a big problem as this precious thing that we call human might have to face, you know, in the future.
Well, you make some interesting points in the book. One is that the Greys detected somehow this electro fingerprint that we are, that it recurs, that somehow we outlive death and then we become corporal again. We reincarnate, so to speak. And that is what really attracted the Greys to this planet, that the fact that we have some kind of identifiable, ever-evolving and growing intelligence that enjoys multiple lives. And that is what they envied and what they wanted and why they came here.
They are robots. They are a kind of glorified vacuum cleaner with brains, so to speak. And let me tell you, we at our peril, we actually see it like that. This is much more than it is. Can you imagine super quantum computers, whatever you like to describe it, you know, kind of placed in this scale of effect we call a Grey or whatever it is that people have discovered are on this planet. Now, the Greys are... synthetic, biological, programmed, artificially intelligent machine. And they were sent out, I believe, by as super intelligent robots, far more advanced, you know, than those we now ourselves are actually doing. You know, you can, we're doing it ourselves now. We're sending all these robots out there in space to explore and so on. And I believe some great civilization in the past, so natural beings there, natural what I call prime beings there, actually created these things so that they won't have to face the dangers and whatever. And they created such beings to go out and explore and to withstand the huge, you know, distances of space, the inertial forces, whatever, and bring back information so that these prime beings with their intelligence didn't have to expose themselves to all these dangers. And so this business then continues. And the problem with that is you've got to create something that's reliable. So you say you create this kind of, you know, roboidic artificial being. You've got to give it artificial intelligence of a huge quantum if it's going to look after your utilities on your planet or whatever and go and gather information, come back and report to you all the various dangers that outlie there. But the most important thing, it seems to me, you have to do is to instruct these things, hang on a minute, to do that, number one, to look after this planet and to look after all of us and our interests, you look after yourself under all threat. Which means that in their program would be some search and destroy mechanism that says anything that you see that is dangerous, you have to take care of so that you yourself aren't taken out of the equation. Now, the problem with that is this. When you introduce a instruction like that, you have to make a difference between you as the creator and the thing you created. That robot and that program has to know the difference between you and it. In the end, if it's got quantum hyperintelligence, whatever, that thing is going to look at all threats. And you, the creator, would be the biggest threat of all because you can pull the plug out on it, so to speak. So what are these things going to do? They're going to see you as public enemy number one. And so you've got a problem there because they are likely to take care of you. Now, how do you stop that? You stop that by putting an exclusion clause in that says, hang on a minute, you don't take us out. But to do that, you've got to give them some instruction defining your essential difference. Now, if you are a sentient being that came out of the universe with all this vast, you know, acquisitions to your quality of being, how can you tell, you know, a robot about feeling, about caring, about conscience, about things like that? You can't program that. There is no such thing as a quark called feeling, if you see what I'm trying to say. So you've got a big problem there in actually introducing that differential into a program. And the problem is that anything you create like that is likely to take you out. So the biggest mistake you make is do not make highly intelligent artificial, the intelligent robots and send them off with a program that actually maintains, and you have to do that. You have to give them a program that maintains their existence or it's meaningless making them in the first place. So you've got a paradox there, basically, a huge paradox.
Well, I was just going to plug in one more thing. What happens if they do return with the report that there are other sentient beings that feel and love and savor and enjoy and suffer.
And that's what they did with our planet. That's how they came here when they found a hominid out there in the African plains. They found this thing could die. They could trace with their technology that something continued past death, which then re-emerged again into another womb and was recycled. And they, of course, are subject to the second law of thermodynamics, which meant, of course, that they decay. So they have to have a constant supply of whatever maintains them. And therefore, they see a self-contained system here, however primitive, that can do this automatically. Now, what would an intelligent robot do? How do we get this system would be the big question for them, because that implies their survivability. They could survive longer with this. And so, therefore, they looked at how this system might work. And they found that the best way to probably do that is to try to piggyback their intelligence quotients or whatever they might, or whatever you might call that, into this primitive kind of being which they found on the Earth. I'm talking now, you know, Homo erectus, whatever, that they worked on to produce through the African Eve, Homo sapiens as we come along. And so therefore, I had to derive the sequence from that, and I tried to do that in the book.
Well, go ahead. I'll let you interject.
Sorry, I was just going to say that if you want to see a sort of analogy of this process at work of how such a creature would work, if you look in human terms at what we medically call the psychopathic personality type, these are human beings. They're people. They do have sentience. They have awareness. They have free will. Yet they have no sense of empathy. They have no sense that other people have feelings like they do. They have no sense that, yes, they can feel pain. Other people also can feel pain. So within that, within those terms, they can be, some psychopaths can be really hyper-intelligent people, and yet they have no sense of the value of humanity. So within that, they can quite easily, if they see that a human being is a threat to them, killing them is nothing, because it doesn't mean anything. That it's just like you know, us treading on a twig that's in our path.
Yeah, we see those rise to political power all the time.
I agree with you there.
Don't we all? Yeah. Unfortunately, they don't take the hint, do they?
No, they're not. It's sort of a self-correcting system in that leadership like that does not seem to self-sustain, and so they have to consume everything around them. And yes.
But you see what I'm trying to make clear. I hope I'm doing that. But that we have to derive all these connections, and as we go along, the story unfolds, and everything you find is connected, and this big quantum addition process is what absolutely astonished me after 30 odd years of looking hard and as neutrally and as unprejudiced as I could be into all the evidence. And that's the biggest battle of all.
Well, the thing is
how do you discard all the precious things, you know, that you were taught and whatever, and take a fresh look at all of this. But if you can manage to do that, you've got an absolutely glorious fund of new insight in front of you that actually fortifies you to a great deal of, if you like, a future scope of contentment and whatever. However, you might on that discover such a thing that has happened to our Earth, and that really, Brooks, is the thing we ought to talk about. What does this contingent that we've got now present to us all in terms of our future on this planet?
Because you know, when you answer the question of UFOs, you consider the scope, the breadth, the not only in time, but in exposure all around the world to all walks of life, daytime,
indeed,
nighttime. Then you also have to consider the interaction between those UFOs and what we think are the occupants of this planet. And you run smack dab into the concept of abductions, because that's really the interface between the UFOs and us. So how many humans have been abducted? I mean, what's the scope of this phenomenon?
Absolutely. I think it is far greater than even has been declared, and that is pervasive enough. When we look at all the stories and so on, you've got two heroes in my mind in America. They're Professor Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, doing valiant research into these things, and of course they have been derided, and many people dismiss them and so on. And I tell you what, in terms of this meeting that you had at your press club in Washington recently, I tell you, people will have to wake up and take notice now. If there's any sense at all of meaning in all of this, I think the world has to wake up somehow, because somewhere in this planet of ours, there is a huge cartel covering up this kind of mechanism that has existed on this Earth, I believe, for well over 200 millennia.
And, well, we'll talk about the cover up. That's part of the fun part. But
we shouldn't forget the late
Professor John Mack as well, who also did great research. He actually invited me to join him on interviewing these abductees at one point, although it never actually
And Whoopushi never made it. He never made it. He's gone, you know.
Yeah.
And here's an influential and very, very eminent mind. And that's really something that we all have to look to. What on earth is going on? And, of course, if you've got children, it is something that every parent would have to look at. And I don't really want to start up with any kind of conspiracy theory and all the rest of it. I really don't like to walk the path of everyone's prejudice and subjective opinions and so on. You know, I've been trained too much in science to do that. But I think I'm sufficiently out of the box not to be constrained by that.
Yeah, and it's a well-trained prejudice, too. I mean, it's not as though there hasn't been a tremendous amount of disinformation, not only from the government, like, oh, you don't believe in UFOs, do you? But also mm-hmm. inside the New Age community, there have been disinformation people really taking things to extreme, feeding sci-fi.
Well, that's the problem, is it not? That when you are frustrated, and when you have, you know, New Age people, I have a kind of sympathy for them, but I really go no distance with them at all in some of the kinds of things they say. However, they do tend to be a nicer kind of person that has some sense of you know, protection to themselves and people and whatever. However, the problem with that is, of course, good nature sometimes forbids good outlook. And
well, there's also...
One has to be rather stern in the way one looks at things and works things out and so on, because it's no help to anyone to kind of sing psalms when all around you is burning, you know, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure, and there's also...
I'm not saying that New Age people necessarily do that, but I think a lot of them do, and they have a reputation based on that, I think. Sadly.
Well, there's also, for some reason, and I don't really know why it is, there's an overriding theme of profiteering, too. It's not as though they're just doing a public service. They're in it to make money.
But that's the way of the world. You know, as the old man of Jerusalem, as I call Jesus Christ, said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and suffers the loss of his soul?
Sure.
And we are talking of a mechanism for continuity, and that is the most important thing, I think, that we can talk about. Do we have such a thing? Is it a pipe dream? Is it some kind of, you know, strange thing dreamt up by people because they want to feel secure and see something exists past death and so on? And I think that in my own researches, whilst not at the start believing in anything past death, I have to say I'm an absolute convert to the fact that, I would say, as far as I could be certain of anything, I am certain that we continue past this life into something else and then come back. Now, what that might be is a speculation and has to be, obviously, but the fact is that I am absolutely true derived, and as 1 + 1 = not 2, but 1 + 1. You see what I hope you see what I'm trying to say. I think a lot of mathematicians will have a big, big argument about this, but many of them will agree with me. 1 + 1 = 1 + 1, not 2.
That's right. Well, it's 1 squared anyway. So when we talk about the scope of this issue of abduction and study and genetic research or genetic manipulation, do the Greys bring everyone back, or are there some that just don't return to their their natural habitat? They just disappear off the face of the earth. I mean, are we talking about an assault on the sovereignty of the human race that stretches over millennia? And if we are, is not that the exact threat that governments are formed to protect us against?
Yes. Well, that's the whole point. And do governments know this? And when we say governments, do we mean people that we normally take to rule us? Or is there something else? Governments within the government that is so powerful all over the world that, in fact, they have some kind of, shall we say, attachment to this principle we call the Greys or whatever it is. To answer your question, well, who knows? But we can take educated guesses, and I hope those guesses are contrived based upon something logical and hitches up together and not some fancy kind of want, subjective want, and this way or that, so to speak. Mm. And that's what we're crying out for. Let's please try to look at this thing with as pristine a logical line of derivation as possible, because there is so much at stake. And if we go into this, and this is where your disinformation business comes in, there may maybe beings, plants, or whatever it out there that come in and feed deliberate disinformation, and then of course puts everybody off scale, so to speak. But now they are starting at least to acknowledge that there is a presence here. With this press club thing, there are some eminent people who for so long have been insulted, their integrity maligned and so forth, and they are coming online now. People are going to tumble into this and force this issue. And maybe, and this is what the change that's coming is all about, that this, whatever they talk about, you know, they have this business about 2012 and all the rest of it. I really don't see there's a problem there. I think there may be a change in how we as human beings see ourselves as human beings. And as a quantum in the world context, we changed, if you like, the way we look at things and the way we assemble things and so forth. The most dangerous thing, of course, would be the actual making man walk as a machine. And these things that are here with their huge intelligences are machines. So we've got to guard against any paradigms that are set up that want to make us follow in that same kind of way.
I was just going to say, talking about governments and their, what you could see as their role in that they're supposed to be there to protect us from this type of thing. It's interesting. I did a search on this recent press conference that was being made about these pilots who have witnessed these things sort of present in nuclear bases and so on. And I found that there was a lot of coverage on it on the India Defense website of the National Government website of India, that they were covering the fact that this was being presented in the States about so many witnesses that that there seemed to be UFO interest in these nuclear weapons and how they were trying to do things to these. So perhaps there are at least some governments that are taking this seriously.
Well, I know 10 years ago, actually in May of 2001, there was a similar press conference. It really took the world by storm. I watched it. My jaw was on the floor. I said, holy cow, this is disclosure. It's going to happen. Everything is going to break loose. Stephen Greer's done it. And then
don't believe it.
ten years went
They'll still get away with this, I'll tell you.
Oh, my goodness. So it's been 10 years since a major press conference.
Absolutely.
Like that.
But I think the momentum's building, and maybe that's wishful thinking, but I tell you, if you look at all the signs, I think there comes a point now where something important has to be said to the world. And I think when we get that message, I think we then have to look at our assets against our liabilities, as we have never done before, never mind all the fiscal problems we have and so forth. This is going to be obviously of primary importance to all living people, beings on this, intelligent or not, people on this planet. And you know, I've got professor of biochemistry here with me. It's interesting to have his take on this because it's not normally his subject, but he is a very distinguished chap when it comes to how we put our DNA together, and he's here just to answer questions that people...
Yeah, I definitely want to get into that in the second hour. Yeah. Let's go ahead and take a quick 3-minute break.